Blog Talk Radio.
Turn that dial because you have just reached the outer limits of Taino Radio. Hola, Dio Taino. Here we go. This is Tuesday night. You know what that means, right? Nuestra noche de indigenous Caribbean study hour. All right. AKA Taino study hour. I'd like to welcome everyone. Bienvenido, Mabrica, todo el mundo. Nuestro show aquí en Taino Radio, Radio Taino. Hold on a second. I got some little technical difficulties here once again. Yeah, we still got some residue from the Spooky Lou show. So we got some problems here. Well, we can figure this out. At this time, I'd like to bring in my guest host right here. He made a special appearance on Saturday night when we had the Indigenous Club, we play some indigenous music. That's actually a new show on Saturday nights. You can tune in, and we're going to have a lot of fun with that one Saturday night. You can always send in your favorite tunes at TainoRadio.com or Taino Radio T91. Hold on a second. We got some issues here. Oh, man, dude, we got some issues going on here. My keyboard, my studio is going nuts. Oh, damn, Men in Black, I'm telling you. The Men in Black, what are you doing here? All right, folks, I just want to fix this right here. Later on, we're going to open up the lines. Guests call in at 515-602-9792. That's 515-602-9792. Man, we got an awesome show. We're going to go back in time. We're going to go back to the Chican Ostenoid era, 1000 Common Era, up until the 1500s Common Era. You know what that culture is all about? That's the Chican Ostenoid. That's an amazing time period in Caribbean indigenous culture that spans before that a good 7,000 years of indigenous culture. So, I'm trying to fix the studio here. So, special guest host right here, take it away.
Hey, how you doing? This is, thank you, Sana Cody, for having me here today. Once again, it was a great time being here on Saturday. This is Wolfman Jack. How you doing, man? That's right, man. I love this studio. It's often haunted. This is why I'm here. Wolfman Jack, baby. There we go. I loved it. It was great being an indigenous club, or I should say club indigenous. What am I saying? Wow. So, yeah, so you got a great show, Sana Cody, trying to teach the culture. That's great. It's Wolfman Jack. For people that don't know me, I was big, big time, 60s and 70s in the airwaves, radio. I know video is awesome. You know, the visuals is always the best, but I tell you, man, radio, when you can paint the picture, baby, that's the best. It's Wolfman Jack, baby.
Hey, man, thanks a lot, Wolfman Jack. You know, you've been a presence so far here in Taino Radio. Yeah, we're having some problems. It's definitely, I probably sound psychotic right now, but there's definitely a haunting going on. But, so since we're haunting, well, you know, I don't like that word, haunted. Kind of gives like that Hollywood. How about, hey, the spirits are alive here in Taino Radio. How about that? Let's get more traditional. The old Piaz out here. Okay, so thank you, Wolfman Jack, for being with us and, you know, checking us out here. You'll be back, right, this Saturday?
That's right, baby. I'm going to be back in Club Indigenous. That's going to be fun. I got some songs I want to play from Johnny Cash. How about that one, man? Johnny Cash was a good man, man. He has some good tunes.
Hey, that's good. Thanks a lot, Wolfman Jack. We're gonna continue our show here with Indigenous Caribbean Study Hour, a.k.a. Taino Study Hour. How about that? Let's bring it back to the Taino. So I think I got the board here. Hold on a second. You know, Tuesdays is hard, man. Tuesdays is hard because after the Spooky Loo show, you know, spirits hang around. Men in Black kind of try to mess us up. On Wednesdays, though, we get cut off a lot on Wednesdays when we do the Indigenous Power Hour activism show. Some crazy stuff be going on there. But, hey, if you're listening out there, if you can hear me, that is amazing. That means we're not totally turned off the air. And the Men in Black have not taken over. But that's all right, man. Taino Radio is neutral, you know. Okay, so let's see if we can connect this here. Let's see. Thank you, Wolfman Jack, for putting in a good word for us. All right.
Yeah,
all right. That's good, man. That's good, big man, man.
All right, that's good. You know, I kind of hired Wolfman Jack from the dead to help us with this studio with the spirit, you know?
Yeah, I was having some, like, technical difficulties, but then it suddenly it just worked again. All I did was, like, turn my phone off and back on again.
No, it's the Men in Black. We had a show part two of the Men in Black.
That's right.
But it's kind of cool since we're talking. That means we're not totally censored. That means they're just, you know, trying to bust our chops. But it's all right, man. Here we are. We're Indigenous, man. We're here first, you know.
Exactly.
We're just here to talk the truth, right? And try to educate our
Absolutely.
People. That's all we're trying to do, right?
Absolutely.
No threat.
Keep
no threat,
it real.
Right?
Yep.
No threat. We're not threat to any establishment. We're just trying to be cool. And hey, we're showing unity here, right? So
absolutely,
come on, man. Right. So how you feeling today?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. I'm glad to be back. Missed last week, but it's good to be back now. I don't know about y'all, but down here we had like a massive Urukan earlier. I was feeling the storm god really. Present as I was walking home from work, it went from like 0 to 10 in like a second. It was light and it was sunny, and then it got dark and it was windy, and the rain came down, and I was like, oh geez, I thought I was gonna get stuck out in it. And I was worried, you know, because I'm walking home from the metro, and I'm like, okay, let me get home before it gets real too bad, you know. And I'm talking to the god Urukan, and I'm saying, like, come on, help me out here. I mean, I know you got to do what you got to do, but I'm screwed if I'm stuck out here in this. And thankfully, I made it home just in time, so I'm very grateful for that. So I guess he was listening.
I said, bueno, yeah, you know, he made an appearance. Also with Coatlistie, all that water coming down. And
yeah.
Guatauba with the thunder, man. What do you think about that? I love that one.
I always think it's cool. Like, I love storms, especially in the summer. I think it's just a cool thing to witness, you know, and to listen to. When I was a kid, my dad used to take us out on the front porch and just listen to it. And he'd, you know, teach us about the timing between the thunder and the lightning. And it's like, no wonder, like, our ancestors regarded things like storms as these, like, all-powerful divine beings, you know, because it is. You can just feel it when you're there, right?
Yo, you know, when here's something cool. When I was in Borinquen, I spent like 4 months there, you know, trying to learn and stuff. And,
right.
Man, let me tell you something. For the first time, there was a thunderstorm with lightning and everything. And
mm-hmm.
Literally, I felt like it was on top of my roof. It's like everything is intensifying the islands.
Yeah.
It's like a microscope. It's like you feel it. It's like, so I got a little glimpse of, wow, I wonder how our ancestors felt. And I was in a cement house. Imagine being in a bohio.
A bohio, yeah.
And I'm like, like, literally the house started to shake a little bit. And I was like, yo,
I'll
what
bet.
Is this? It was a regular thunderstorm, lightning. Wasn't a hurricane. Oh, that's what it was. It was an old-fashioned Caribbean rainstorm, lightning storm,
yeah.
Whatever.
Which feels like a hurricane sometimes.
You know, I've been accused many times of being scared and stuff, but listen, I was kind of, I won't say I was shaking, but it kind of got my attention. Like, yo.
Sure, so, yeah.
It's like primal. It's like primordial, you know, like, wow. Back in the cage,
right.
You know?
There's
like,
a
this is
massive
cool.
Respect
I like this.
For it, right.
Yeah, man. Like, this is cool, man. So, well, you know, today's topic is be interesting because it's about the roles, you know, of, and basically focusing on the Chicán Ostenoid, 1000 Common Era to 1500 Common Era, what we call the Taíno culture, right? Or
right.
Pre-Columbian. Pre-invasion, I should say. Pre-invasion.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
pre-Columbian. Same thing.
Right? Pre-invasion. The roles of cacique,
yeah.
and the Behique. So with that, guess what? I got a special guest that's going to be talking with us today about that. Guess what?
Oh, sweet.
A little surprise. Yeah, I wanted to surprise
yeah.
you.
Yeah?
Hold on
Aww.
A second. And this is... You know, Taíno Radio is a public service from Arayeque. So we got our cacica, Inalu Boria. Stephanie is on the line. Are you with us?
Oh, Steph, that's awesome. Hey, guys. Hi, Sanakori. Hey, Matt.
Hey.
Hey, Steph. Long time.
How you doing?
Hey.
Doing all right. Good to talk to you again.
Bye. Yes,
there you go.
It's been a while.
Yeah, absolutely. This
is
awesome. A nice surprise.
We're out boogieing in the powwow, right? Back in Pennsylvania, was it?
Yeah. That seems like forever ago now.
Where there was a little young girl, Malia, was dancing, right?
That's,
she absolutely
right.
That's right. So
hey,
great.
If there's any leadership out there listening, I was trying to get some folks on the line. You know, if there's any Behiques, Caciques out there listening to the show live, it's around 10:14 Eastern time. And definitely, you know, you can call in and add some of your experience, some of your understanding of the roles. But we're going to focus on that 1,000 to 1,500. You know, Taíno culture is not that long. It's interesting. The archaeologists,
well, yeah,
right?
If we're talking
and the anthropologists.
If we're talking classical Taíno culture, yeah, that would be about right. But I mean, I guess if we take it into context of, you know, like the Arawakan you know, Aboriginal people who were there for, like, it's not an exact, I mean, dating is not, especially from an anthropological perspective, is not exact, but yeah, that would be considered like the classical period, I would say, like the golden age or whatever of Taino culture.
The zenith, right?
Right.
So
there you go.
Yeah, because nothing is an accident. It's like there's continuation, right? There's layers and layers of culture, right?
Right, right.
And I guess one estimate, right? 1,000 Common Era. Boom, there was an explosion that we call Taino.
Right.
Right?
That was the Renaissance.
The Renaissance, yeah. And it lasted what? 1,000, 2, 3, 4, wow, less than 400 years, right? 400?
Yeah, which seems like not a lot, but in the context of empires and everything, it's not, like, I mean, compared to, like, other societies or like empires that were on a much larger scale, it's respectable.
But you know what, I want to give a special shout out to, you know, it's a known fact, and Stephanie could attest to this, that our studio here is, I won't say haunted, but it's definitely been visited by opias and stuff, but
I believe it.
You know, one of my favorite cultures that definitely influenced Taino culture is the Huecan Saladoy culture, which is what we call right now presently Vieques, that has that Andean blood, and they're known for that.
Right.
That, what is it? The condor necklace. It's like a semi that has the condor on it and stuff. So
imagine
all the way from the Andean mountains, these indigenous people settled in Vieques, a little small island of Vieques. And so I say that just to say, wow, layers and layers and layers of different influences, right?
Right, so, from all over, yeah, the Americas, and particularly in, like, South and even Mesoamerica, technically, if we want to go, it's Southern Florida and North America, too. So it's pretty, you know, like, no one's ever... you're right. There's many layers with culture, especially, like, no one's ever just been in one place the whole time. You know, there's a lot of always outside influence. There's never like a, it doesn't stay the same. That's just not the nature of culture.
Exactly. And, you know, I love this book by Jose Oliver, who talks about the caciques and the idols they worship. You know, I hate the word idol, but that's his language. But he talks about that, right? That in Vieques they found a three-pointer semi, which is the Yokahu, 2330 BC before the Common Era, and 460 before Common Era. So, see, Vieques again, see these influences, the three-pointers. So that leads us to in the future, right? When he talks about Yokahu, three-pointers and stuff, there's definitely a religious connection there. So
absolutely.
So why do I
And three
so
is
why
the
do
number
I bring
we
that
see
up?
In religion all the time now. It's there are a lot of spiritual practices. Three is a holy number, right?
Yep, exactly. And then also you find in Puerto Rico, Borinquen, some of the island, you find that tree that Ana. Let me see if I can pronounce it correctly. I can never pronounce it correctly.
Anacaona?
No, it's Ana de Nancera Peregrini, which is the Cojobana tree, which contains those beans that's used to activate the DMT in the Cojoba ceremony. So you, we still find those. And guess where that came from? I was researching from Jose Olivar. The source is... Huecoy, those Andean people, and
right.
The Cetrasan Saladoy groups that came out of South America. So, man, there you go, man. This is thousands of years before Taino culture blew up. So it's
right.
So here's my thing. Fast forwarded to 1,000 to 1,500. Who are the stewards? Who are the stewards of these ceremonies? Who are the stewards of the semis? Two main characters, right? Cacique and the Bejique. Let's start talking about them.
Right.
What do you think? Let's start rapping.
Yeah.
What's your knowledge?
Just for context for people, I think, you know, it's important to just say pretty much what, I mean, Taino society was kind of divided into what, like four main groups, more or less. We have the cacique and the behique, who you just mentioned, and then the other two that are kind of considered the other two big ones are the ni Tainos, who would be like, I guess the English equivalent would be like the nobles, right? Like kind of those who were or direct servants to the cacique or assistants to the cacique. And then the naborias, which is basically, I guess, again, I'm equating it to English terms just for simplicity's sake, the commoners, I guess, as we would say. So cacique is the what people equate it to most often, obviously, is a chief or a chieftain. And then the behiques, of course, as we know, but for anyone who listening doesn't, those are the spiritual leaders. Those are the doctors, the healers, the ceremonial leaders. I mean, people use the term shaman a lot. So I would say that, yeah, the caciques, and I mean, everyone has their role, right? And they're all important, especially in a society like ours. But the caciques and the behiques were definitely the leaders of especially things like ceremony or even just kind of the maintaining of the community, right?
Right. Is anybody there?
But, yep, we're here.
Oh, I thought we lost everyone. Come on, Wolfman.
No, I thought I
help us out. No, go ahead. So continue.
Oh, no, I was just sorry. I guess I cut out. So, I mean, I was just saying the four main social
right.
groups of Taino society were the cacique, ni Tainos, cajiques, and naborias. But you then were going, I mean, I know you and Steph have more experience in terms of that because of your status within the tribal community. So, I mean, I only know from what I read and hear from others. So I'd really love to hear, like, your perspective
okay.
on what it means to hold that title and everything, you know, and what that means for you and what that means in terms of how other people in the community see you.
There you go. Well, Stephanie, let me ask you, what has been your experience so far in administering, being administrator of Arayeke and being a cacica? Or cacique?
So I think
yeah.
as far as my personal experience within Arayeke, being able to assist in the creation of a space where people can come together to learn, to be educated, to teach one another, to have a safe space to do all of those things, to really create a community. And what we're really trying to do is create a sovereign nation, to be able to be placed in a position to really begin to foster a holistic community that ancestrally can take pieces of what we know and what's been documented as far as what our ancestors did and how our ancestors practiced and their noble endeavors in really being a community and being a family and building that structure and having that independence, that sovereignty. First and foremost, it's a very humbling experience to know that so many people are trusting of my input, trusting of the guidance and the information that's being provided, trusting of the education and continuously sitting with open hearts and understanding. It's something to really marvel at, and both in the role that I have as cacique, as cacica, as well as just as an enrolled member in a tribe, you know, it's a very humbling feeling to know that you have and that you're surrounded by like-minded people that, or whose main goals are really just to continue traditions that were once thought to be eradicated due to the assumed position of being quote-unquote extinct, you know, and existing is literally a form of resistance for us.
Right.
And being able to continuously show that pride in our resilientness, literally by just educating and being educated is it's a wonder. I think that in any leadership roles, the most important aspect of progression and understanding and trust is being able to hold on to a level of humility that allows you to be even and equal with all of the people around you, you know, where they have a level of comfort to be able to come to you and have conversations and share ideas and give feedback and not feel as if they are going to be reprimanded or misunderstood or have it taken out of context. It's important for me to be able to say, I hear you, I understand you, and let's go ahead and try and put all of these ideas into a place where we can continue to learn and work, you know. And again, I take that as my standpoint in my position because that's how I was taught that the Taino people were. They were an understanding group. They were a noble group. They were a joyous, jovial set of people who really did work in marvelous ways. So that's how I try and lead. I try and lead like a wolf. I lead from the back. I support whoever it is that may be my weakest enrollee or member, and you know, support them through their entire process. And anytime somebody starts to feel a little bit out of place or a little unsure, I'm there to catch them and continue to push them forward. So as far as my understanding of the role of cacique, it's a selfless role. It's a role where you understand the weight of the responsibilities that are put on your shoulder. However, you are accepting of the challenge and you do it from the trenches. With the people, for the people, and in the event that it comes to a place of having to stand up for the people, you are the first person to lead that fight, whether it be for land, whether it be for human rights, whether it be for any of our modern issues that we're consistently combating. You know, we recently had a show on colorism, which is a huge issue within the Taino community. And, you know, we're trying to combat that as well, trying to break stigmas. And I think that's a big role that now has been transplanted in completely different ways, but, you know, stems from the original practices of who the caciques were back in the day. You know, they were fearless. They stood for their people. You know, they fought for their people. They made sacrifices for their people, regardless of how they may have been perceived. So, you know, taking the traditional sense of the role and then buying it into today's day and age and how we can continue to be instrumental and, you know, provide those means of showing that character. I think that's a very big part of what it is to be a cacique in modern times. And I think, you know, a lot of people will agree when they reflect on who their cacique is, that those are qualities that they would see in how they operate when there's things going on within their general community or their specific Yukayekes. And, you know, for the most part, I think that a lot of us share that overall in general, because it's not like there's a cacique school, guys. We don't have that luxury. We have to really rely on the information and the teachings and, you know, the traditionalism and being able, a little bit that we have, and modify it to modern days, modern times, because unfortunately our ancestors don't have, you know, they had that large break between their population being, you know, abundant to everything that happened in between till now. And, you know, while we have documentation of some things, there are certain situations that would not have been present at those times that we have to be able to respond and react to. So, I think that's a big thing when it comes to just the role and the title of cacique. And I don't think without a proper bejique, you know, and tequinas in their corner, caciques would be able to handle a lot of the things that are thrown their way. You know, it's the bejiques play a huge role in molding and teaching the cultural practices, the traditions, the ceremonies, you know, from young children into their adulthoods or into their cacique roles. So, you know, the bejiques, while they oftentimes stay in the shadows, the caciques deserve a lot of recognition for their work and their culture keeping in the community itself. We wouldn't have a lot of the things that we currently have as far as information goes if it wasn't for the bejiques that were able to hide and preserve the culture. You know, the jíbaros that were able to maintain a lot of the culture as well and pass that on from generation to generation.
Exactly. Well, you know, thank you for sharing those words. You know, I'm going to challenge both of you,
definitely.
Okay? I'm going to challenge both of you, okay? First is your listening skills. Now we're doing like a true study group now.
Oh,
right,
man.
Here on live radio.
The quiz now.
Yeah, but look, no, I'll give you the answers before. No, but
okay,
but
no,
this is an excerpt from the book by Jose Olive, I should say. He's a Puerto Rican and Catalan as well, so he has that Spanish blood as well. He's an archaeologist. And his specialty is archaeology of the Caribbean and South America, the northern part.
Ooh.
And he's from the Institute of Archaeology, University College London in Bloomsbury. I love his books. I want to rip whatever hair I got left. I want to rip it all because he's so detailed, you know. Just when you want to rush, you have to go back and say, damn, did I miss something? But this is from the book Caciques and Semi-Idols, The Web Spun by Taino Rulers Between Española and Puerto Rico. Now, he did get into Cuba there in some of the chapters later on, but more on the religion part, the spirituality. But I want to read from his book, and I want you guys I need your feedback, okay? And then we're going to break this down to all the listeners out there. Hold on a second. Let me just flip my phone here. You know, I bought this little laptop, and it doesn't work. So I'm using my...
Of course not.
Oh, this is not right. Oh, so now it's invading my phone. Okay, I get it. The Men in Black.
Oh,
there you go. So hold on a second.
Not
this is not fair.
Black.
I can't believe this. Wait a minute. How did the Men in Black get into my phone? That's not fair. Hold on. Literally, they got in my...
That's not fair.
Wait a minute. I had this whole... Wait a minute. No, no. Nothing should surprise us,
right? It always
happens. No, I had this phone... Okay. Here we go. But it's not flipping, so it's like really tiny, the words. And of course, it's not.
Get your glasses on.
Okay, here we go. Ready? Now, the term cacique, and he translates it as cacique among the Lakonos from Guyana, the Arawak speakers.
Meaning to keep house, is that right?
It simply translates as male or female head of the house.
Yeah, to keep house. Yeah, okay. That was close.
Yeah, so he did. That's it. So he says, you get half a point. No, it's not. All right. It equally refers to the head of the family, lineage, or co-residential group, as much as it refers to a leader of an entire polity. They are all caciques. Wow. En Española, Bishop Las Casas, in his Complete History of the Indies, Book 3, page 555, identifies degrees of seniority among the caciques through a set of three words of deference used when addressing a senior leader. And this is the first one. Matunjeri was reserved for the highest ranking cacique, akin to saying Your Highness. Bahari was used for a second ranking cacique, akin to saying Your Lordship. While Guajeri, right? Guajeri was used to address the third ranking persons, which was perhaps local caciques or nitainos. And there was a fourth term, and it was for the high-ranked persons, okay? Guamiquina, or Guamehehi, Guamajeri. And this recorded both in Española, or Quisquea, Haiti, and Puerto Rico, Borinquen. Guamequina is a compound of our Lord, Guama, or principal or first. So let's stop right there. Four different terms. So obviously, the Casa spent a lot of time trying to understand this. So our people were definitely complex, right? Their political structure. They were definitely organized, right? So what do you guys think about that? Want me to repeat the words again? So cacique was basically head of the household, right?
What
lineage.
Was that one? I mean, the one that, what was the one, repeat it, the one that was the equivalent of Your Highness?
Yeah.
Matuhari. Yeah, what was that word? Matuhari.
He was the highest ranking cacique.
Right.
Matuheri, Your Highness. Yeah.
Right.
And Bahari was the
it's
second.
Interesting.
That's the role that Aguabana played, right?
Who?
Aguabana. He was a Matuheri.
Aguabana?
Right?
Aguabana? Uh-huh. Yeah, he was the Matuheri, yeah.
Right. So that's like the Your Highness one.
Yeah.
Or
cacique of caciques.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know. For me, it's always like, I know they're trying to equate it to something that they can understand from, like, their European context, but obviously, like, our
right.
society and leadership was not the same as theirs. So, you know, a cacique is not a king. They are not, like, equivalent, in my opinion,
right.
to a European king in the way,
right. Okay.
in terms of being, like, that's just, you know, what I would think is, I mean, obviously, yeah, that's the best comparison that they have from their perspective. But as I think Steph just made completely clear, you know, European monarchies were more about kind of control and power, and heredity was a big thing
mm-hmm.
of being a ruler, and less about, you know, really being, as we said, the original word means a head of the house, which in my opinion breaks down to like caring for your people and being kind of like the father figure or household head of your people, and a lot of all the responsibility that kind of goes with that, and really ensuring the well-being of everyone in kind of a more egalitarian setting, as opposed to being like, I feel like the European rulers and monarchies were often thought to be almost like semi-divine in some ways, like, oh, God chose them to be king and queen, mm-hmm. et cetera, and therefore they get to do whatever they want and and it's really not so much about the well-being of the people or the state. It's kind of just, you know, it's absolute rule. And I don't feel that's what a cacique was in the same sense, and certainly not today by any standards based on what Stephanie said. But, I mean, Steph, you can speak better to that than I can, but that's just my opinion.
No, I agree with you 1,000%. Honestly, I think that the way history has been written, it's very, very Eurocentric, you know.
Right.
So in order for history to be history, it has to be sprinkled with that Europeanness. If not, it's not deemed worthy enough to be listed in the history books. So when we have Europeans who left us prerequisites and, you know, the beginning of, quote-unquote, our information, it comes from their Eurocentric views. It comes from their European values and their understanding of things, and it creates this fantastical idea of what
right.
Indigenous is, just overall and in general.
Right.
So while I understand,
yeah, even the fact that, yeah, they use, like, people refer to Pocahontas as like a princess.
Oh my God.
A lot
yeah,
of time,
no,
right? Like,
I can't.
She wasn't a princess. Like, there were no, we didn't
no.
have princesses. We didn't have, she was high ranking, certainly, but there were no Indian princesses, even though that's become such a big trope, right,
right.
for indigenous people.
So many people have, you know, Cherokee grandmothers that were princesses.
Great
you know, that's their thing.
Yeah.
That's their thing. And again, that's that nice little razzle dazzle of that European seasoning,
romantic,
I'll call it.
Yeah.
Right. So it puts us in a position of that's how they were able to kind of explain everything. And it really takes scholars and archaeologists and anthropologists of the culture to really dig in and do the research and go to these places and, you know, find the sources to dispel the inaccuracies that are written. You know, we can sit here and argue for days that Columbus didn't discover anything, you know. However, from a European standpoint, Columbus is
right.
an almighty explorer. From an indigenous standpoint, we know otherwise. So when we rely on the European texts to tell us, hey, look, this is what you guys were called. This is the ceremonies that you guys used to do. This is how you used to honor your deities. It becomes a place of how much do I want to take from that and how much do I want to actually do legwork for? And that's where a lot of the division becomes apparent, you know, between different sects of the, you know, groups, because they'll rely on these Eurocentric viewpoints and they won't do the research on the island or with their, you know, elders and other people that have been, you know, very well-versed in the culture, and they accept, you know, the fact that a cacique is this divinely bestowed title for
right.
a lineage that exceeds X amount of hundreds of years, and it's improbable or it's impossible for you to be able to be a Bejique because you don't come from a lineage and you can't trace it back and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, where we know from, you know, cultural stories and lore and, you know, what has been passed down, that oftentimes Bejiques didn't come from direct lineage in some instances,
right.
you know, some areas, the grandmothers helped, you know, figure out who was going to contain which title throughout the Yucayec, you know, so that whole idea of comparing the King of Kings for Paris, you know, for me, I stand right there with you. It doesn't make sense to me because it can't be the king of, you know, of it all. It's not Your Highness. It is the cacique of caciques. You know, it is that person who will have, you know, the view, you know, and be able to share that knowledge and that strength and, you know, that counsel to all of the other caciques. However, it's not a king. It's not a king of kings. It will never be how the Europeans viewed their monarchs in any way, shape, or form, I don't think.
Right, I agree. And it just creates, I think, that word, you know, I mean, because we can't help it, like words and visions and certain ideas come to mind when we hear the word king or Your Highness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to get it away from, like you said, that Eurocentric viewpoint is more difficult to do when you keep using, when you say, like, well, a cacique or a chief or a behique is like a king or like a this, like
mm-hmm.
a that, because then that, like, you know, kind of twists people's perspective a little to be like, oh, well, and look again from that Eurocentric viewpoint. So, yeah, I mean, I get, like, what you're saying, of course, like, when you're coming from a completely different culture, the easiest thing for most people to do, to default to, is to try to compare something they don't understand or something new to them to something in their own culture. It's just the way we, as humans, process things. So
mm-hmm.
I understand why they did it, but again, I think just in terms of what I know from what a cacique's responsibility or a behique's responsibilities were, how they come into that title, it's vastly different from anything European or anything that
mm-hmm.
any Taino people would have had any concept of at that time, of that idea of being like an absolute ruler with absolute power to do just whatever you want all the time without considering the good of the group, right, and the collective. And the idea of having to be born into it as well, the role of that status is static and you can't change it or you can't move from this or that just because you weren't born, you didn't happen to be born to the right set of parents, et cetera. And even from what I've read, there's some evidence to show that some caciques, yeah, definitely had like a hereditary connection. But from what I've read, there's evidence that some were established through more democratic means as well,
mm-hmm.
Meaning like they were chosen because of their
exactly.
their leadership abilities, their you know, their virtues, not like almost like I guess what we would make a modern day comparison to like voting for someone who we
right,
liked
exactly.
or something. But you know, it that could be anybody, right? It didn't have to be from a specific class. It didn't have to be any Taino or someone who came from a long line of established rulers.
Exactly.
Now, just to be fair with the Jose, you know, who was exactly the opinion, right? It says,
right,
he writes later on in the chapter, he writes, this is all in chapter 2, suffice it is to say that the classic definitions of the hierarchically ranked chiefdoms are inadequate for describing the diverse nature of the cacicascos in, which is the Yucayeques in the Greater Antilles.
Right. Yeah.
And probably hierarchy.
At least he acknowledges it.
Yep. And he says probably hierarchy should be considered more seriously. But then he says I think there are some useful insights to be drawn, and he mentions a Brazilian group. Tribe. Let me see. Hold on. What is he name? Oh, the Xinguano. I think they're linguistically connected to our ancestors, and they see hierarchy in particular in case of peer cacicascos. So it's like peer Yucayeques. All right. So it's not so much hierarchical, but peer. So there's much to learn from the current. Right, that's what he's saying. Yeah, he goes deep into it, you know, the from the sources that was like, you know, De La Casas and all that.
Yeah, and it's good that he does acknowledge. And again, I'm not knocking him for his comparison.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
I
no,
said,
no,
that's what we do.
Just want to make sure
we're from another.
Yeah.
No, no, I understand, and yeah, no disrespect to him, of course. No, he's. I'm familiar with his work. I know what. He definitely did his research and worked to the best of his ability. And yeah, that's just what you do when you're from a different culture and you're trying to understand a new concept, you compare it to something you're more familiar with. Right. But he himself realized as an outsider, the differences, which I think really speaks exactly to what Steph and I were saying.
Now, it was interesting that the Spaniards or the invaders, they used to refer to the caciques as señor, I mean, don or doña, right? So
right.
They referred to Aguabana as don, but his mother, they call her Doña Inés, doña. So here you go. So
yeah.
Was she a cacique? They referred to her as a cacique, and she, you know, and they both died during that era. Natural causes, but it seems like she was higher than him. Well, why not? If you go by age, right, or by seniority,
right? And I think
the high rank
elder. I mean, elders always have status in all indigenous culture, pretty much, right? Like even no matter where they technically stand, like elders do have that always have that seniority and that respect accorded to them, and. I mean, so I was reading that sometimes apparently the Spaniards would mistake the cacique's wives or relatives, like you mentioned, like his mother or something, as other caciques because they would think, they say, like, wow, these women seem just as powerful and to have just as much respect accorded to them as a cacique, so they must be a cacique too. And I guess coming from a very, you know, patriarchal culture and society that they did, that was like their only explanation. Like it wasn't in their understanding to think like, oh, these are women who they don't necessarily have to be a cacique, but because again, we're a matrilineal society and the wife of a cacique is very important, just as most of our women are. And the mother of a cacique being an elder, as she probably would be, is even more so. So,
right.
Whether some of them were actually, you know, had the title or not, I think is a little harder to determine. But, you know, regardless, they were still awarded kind of that same respect and veneration, right? And still considered kind of equally important, I think.
Yeah, they refer to Columbus as Guamiquina, like our Lord, using their terms, European terms.
Right.
A high rank
among
the Spaniards, among the invaders, you know.
Which he wasn't even close to.
Was that? I know, right?
Like just
well, exactly.
Like just in the context, like he wasn't even a noble technically. If we're going back to like where he came from and everything, he was just some guy.
I know. Well, we have some stories of caciques and or cacicas. Do you have any, that's a controversial word too, cacica, but I like to say it's a Taino Spanglish, right? Taino Spanglish?
Yeah, we got to come up with
cacica.
Yeah,
Taino Spanglish, we'll go with that.
Yeah, I mean, people think Spanglish is
Spanglino.
Cool language, you know? That's it, man. But people get it though, right? People get it. Oh, feminine, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah, I mean, and I hadn't heard it until relatively recently. So, I mean, Steph, as you're the one who is a cacique, like, I mean, I get why people came up with it, but I mean, I would say the term cacique isn't necessarily like feminine or masculine, is it?
Well,
I don't think it's feminine or masculine, honestly. And quite frankly, it's either or doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah.
I know that for a lot of people, there's an issue with the word cacica just in general, because they ask or they argue, why are we using Spanish styled structure?
Right.
Taino words. And at that point, it becomes a question of, well, language since then has changed, to be able to adapt the language in a way to actually communicate mm-hmm. amongst one another in a formal and completely understandable format and text, we have to be able to follow some kind of format. You know, there are words that we have now that we didn't have then. So it's a place for people to have to really pick and choose their battle. If somebody calls me cacique in Aruboriashi, all right, that's cool with me. If you want to call me cacica in Aruboriashi, that's fine as well. Either or doesn't take away from the fact that I'm going to, you know, stand in this position and hold my people in a loving, genuine way and bring them to a place of sovereignty, you know? So for me, that cacique, cacica term, you know, some people like cacica, some people don't like cacica. For me, whichever one is used, it's interchangeable, doesn't make much of an issue for me in my mind. And like I said, when it comes to language, which is a whole other topic, when it comes to defend creating structure for modern time, for modern use. So, you know.
Culture is changing always. Language is part of that.
Do you guys, I should say ladies, do you have a favorite cacica?
They language.
You want to share? Yeah, right?
I think my favorite cacica is Luisa.
Interesting.
In general. And overall, I resonate with her quite a lot. The portrait, I think it was Samuel Lynch's portrait of Luisa, mm-hmm. was brought to my attention by somebody, and they threw it next to my picture. I was just like, oh my goodness, it's like a reincarnation. I resonated with her prior to that from the original photo that Samuel Lynch created his photo from. But then I saw it and I was just like, oh, well, I see some things here and there. So I don't know. It's a soft spot that I have for her. Specifically, and then, you know, with cacique, cacique umakao, and aguan,
aguabana,
yeah.
Aguabana, yeah, I know, it's kind of tricky. Aguabana.
Yeah. Aguabana and umakao.
Well, there were two of them.
Are two caciques as well. El Bravo. That's my guy.
Oh, that's the second one. That's the nephew. Yeah, that's the nephew.
That's
He's like, nah,
one,
man, we ain't making peace.
Exactly. Him and Urayang were. Those are my four caciques that I very much resonate with, and I hold in very deep reverence. So the tough ones.
And you know what's funny, you know what's interesting, that Yuisa, she was killed by some warriors, the Aino warriors, because I guess she married, mm-hmm. I forget the guy's name, but
she married
a Spaniard, lieutenant. I think it was a lieutenant. But the thing is, she was being traditional.
Lieutenant.
She was being traditional. You marry the opposing, conflicted
the enemy
tribe.
Yeah. In order to have peace.
Yeah, to make peace, to bring peace to the village.
Exactly.
Right? So
she
was being traditional.
She probably knew what was going to happen, honestly.
Yeah, but I guess you can call her a traditionalist because she used those old tools that maybe didn't apply anymore, but that's what she thought it would, you know, that's the conflict right there, right?
Well, I think either way, from either perspective, I think what she was trying to do was exactly what most of the caciques did. You know, most of the caciques went straight into war. Most of the caciques, you know, when it came down to sharing food with other people, would put themselves in the position of, I'm going to try it first, because if I die, you guys are all going to be safe, you know, and then you guys make sure you avenge me and you save the people. So I think in Luisa's defense, she knew either she was going to be murdered or she thought that she was really going to bridge a peaceful connection. But I don't think she walked into it without thinking of both options. I think
right.
as a cacique or as a cacica, she really strategized that idea of I'm going to lose my people one way or another. Either I'm going to, you know, bridge this peace connection and save some of them, or
mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this and they're going to retaliate and I'm going to lose some of them and myself. So I think it was a strategic move on
yeah.
her behalf in, like I said, in either way. And that's why I think I resonate with her in so many fashions, because it's such a calculated risk that can come with the same outcome in, you know, on both sides. And either way, for her, it was putting her in a position that she wasn't going to be content with. Either she was going to die
right.
or she was going to be in a marriage that she wasn't going to be happy in. So,
right.
I think
a sacrifice for the greater good. It is, again,
exactly.
is what it sounds like to me, which, again,
mm-hmm.
is what I think really differentiates the caciques from more traditional European rulers, because I think you're
exactly.
right. I think it was strategic.
European,
I think it was, she figured that's a way to, like, bring peace about, hopefully. You know, it was Pedro Mejias. Was that her husband?
I'm not sure.
I don't
Pedro
know.
Mejia, was that him?
I thought that's
I
who she married. There was
the
two. I mean, there's
Luisa,
look that up. And then there was like Luisa spelled L-U-Y-S-A.
Well, that's the same one. Yeah, sometimes spelled Luisa
yeah,
or Luisa.
They just spelled
Luisa. You know, they
Luisa
Spanish.
With a Y.
Yeah, why? That's more the Taino, but I guess they mix it too, you know.
Yeah, I think she married Pedro Mejias and even I think she converted to Christianity.
She did, yeah. That's the
yeah.
thing, yeah.
In
right.
order
she,
for her to
she,
be able to marry.
She went all in.
Right, which is, again, not to bring her up again, but, like, I mean, Pocahontas did something a lot similar, and a lot of people believe that, you know, maybe part of it was strategic, like, to kind of, like,
definitely.
Soften relations between her people
mm-hmm.
and the English. Like, obviously a lot of it may have been done against her will, but her father, you know, was a very strategic ruler and a very clearly knew what was going on. And I think, you know, there's more going on than I think people often give these, like, types of unions credit for. They see it from the outside. They're like, oh, they got married. It's like, well, it was a marriage for a reason, where they were laying foundation or groundwork for kind of an alliance, if you will. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I totally agree that I think that it was a big risk and probably a difficult decision to make, because I'm sure she realized there would be opposition.
Yeah.
But ultimately, yeah, and as of course there was, but ultimately, you know, it was what she felt she had to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
How about you, Natalie? Do you have a cacique or cacica that you like?
Well, obviously,
I think I have an idea.
I always got to stand behind my guy Atue, you know. I mean, as a
Atue.
As a Siboney Taina Cubana. I know he's technically from originally from Hispaniola, but he became the kind of big cacique of Baracoa. Yeah, and I just think his story of rebellion and of how he became so kind of immortalized and martyrized in Cuba, especially as kind of our original rebel, you know, and
mm-hmm.
just that whole story of him, you know, being bound to the stake and told, you know, he has one more chance to repent and you know, accept Jesus and then convert to Christianity and he may have a chance to go to heaven and then like his those like immortal words of his that were like, well, are there people like you guys in heaven? And they said, well, yeah, of course. And then he goes, then forget it, I'd rather go to hell because I don't want to be anywhere where any god would allow such cruel people to be around. So I just always think that's really powerful, and that story
mm-hmm.
Has been so mythologized and immortalized in Cuba. There's statues of him everywhere. There's songs about him. It's so he was the first one I learned about growing up for that reason. Mm-hmm. Also a fan of Juanma, another Cuban cacique. And he was the one who was he was actually betrayed and murdered by his brother, apparently. And his brother was Oli Juanma, I believe, was what he was known by. And of course, this is going to sound like really stereotypical, but I've always been an Ana Kaona fan. I just not just because she's so famous as a cacique or female cacique, but just the things I've read about her, like on a more personal level. Like apparently, she was very kind and generous and helpful to runaway slaves that she encountered. Mm-hmm. You know, she was very sympathetic to, and you know, that's kind of like a hit or, like a lot of our people did admix with Africans and slaves, et cetera. But there was some divide, I think, there. And apparently Ana Kaona was very sympathetic to their plight and always welcomed them among her people with open arms, and really kind of laid that foundation of us being the unique kind of syncretized admixed culture that we are today, right, by allowing those people into our circles and into our communities. So always really liked that about her. And then this is another one that's a little more morbid. It's not so much that I like her per se, but I just think what her story is really powerful as well. Again, as like a folklorist and anthropologist, I'm all about the stories. So Kasiwaya, who was the wife of Juanma, the other Cuban cacique I mentioned before, and he was about to be executed, and she was about to be executed as well. But again, they always do that thing. They're like, oh, well, if you know, you're a woman, if you repent and convert to Christianity, I guess we'll go easier on you or something. And she just like kind of stood there and she said, okay, well, let me just, you know, she was going to be like taken away, I guess. And she said, well, can I just hug my children really quick first? And they said, okay, yeah, sure. So she went and hugged, like they sent her children to her. And then she broke both their necks and then ran to like a cliff and hung herself right after shouting, I will never be a slave. The wife of Juanma nor the children of Juanma will never be slaves. And she hanged herself after strangling her own children as well, which obviously, again, very morbid, very extreme. But I always just think it's such like a powerful story that she realized. And again, it's, you know, from an outsider's perspective, people would say, oh God, that's crazy and that's horrible and she's a terrible person. But I think she realized just what kind of misery they were all in for. And wanted to, I think she did it out of love and out of sacrifice to spare herself and her family from that. And yeah, it was a little extreme, but I always just think it's a powerful story.
There you go. That's beautiful, man. That's great. Want everyone to follow up on that.
It's a sad but powerful story. You know, like it always reminds me, like those stories that are so prevalent among, especially like in Latin culture, of like women who kill their children for whatever reasons, like La Llorona and other similar figures are always like so kind of just fascinating to think, like, because it's such a thing we don't associate, you know, women killing their children is like the most unfathomable thing we can imagine. So to hear the stories behind it, it's always, and it always seems to have like colonial ties in some way. Like there's something that led them to that point, you know?
Right. Wow. Well, I know if there are male listeners out there, I know most likely you'll think I will say Cacique Bujikio, also of Haiti region, Haiti, because he had 38 wives. That's the man right there.
And that's why you like him?
Sorry about that. No, that's the popular pick. Oh, man.
Was that Ana Kaona's brother?
Wait, hold on. Bajikyo was the uncle, I believe, of Anakahona, the uncle.
Oh, okay. All right.
I believe he was the uncle or the nephew. Damn it, I always forget now. The uncle or the nephew, but they were definitely related, yeah. So, but that's the pop, and his semi was Korokote, and Korokote was the one that of sexual delight, so you could imagine, right?
So that's why you like him. Great.
You see, I'm just saying, you know. But yeah, Stephanie, you're quiet, man. That's it. I'm going to get in trouble now.
Yeah, me and Steph are getting all feminist about, you know, our favorite female caciques. And Sana Gordy just brings it back to like, yo, this guy was the best because he had 38 wives.
I mean, I think we all showed a little bit of our personality.
True.
You picked a few morbid stories, which I
yeah,
resonate
with. Yeah, I'm
not going
to kill my children.
but it's kind of cool that
the rebels, and here comes Sanakori with his 38 wives.
Yeah, and sexual delight.
And then second place will be
priority.
Second place will be the wife. I mean, the husband of Anakaona, Kaonabo. But the thing that what he did was cool was he tried to kidnap as many wives as he could from Bujikyo, you know, so that was kind of interesting. No, I'm just kidding again. But it was true, though. He did kidnap a lot of his wives. You know what it is power, man. The more women you have, the more power, the semis, you know.
Yeah, still
so
true.
There you go, right? So, yeah, Pokanao, but he did good, though. He wasn't even Taino, though. So it goes to show how our ancestors honored, you know, people from different tribes, you know. If they can lead, they'll be our leader, you know. That was kind of cool. But seriously, my favorite is, and I said this before on the show, he doesn't even have a name. We don't even know his name. It's unknown. From Sauna Island off the Dominican Republic. It faces Santo Domingo. And this I guess he was one of the low-ranking chiefs. But what he did was he took the responsibility of making cassava bread for the invaders. He took sole responsibility to appease their hunger so they can leave them alone, leave the mainland people alone. And then one day, some flunky wannabe Columbus dude, this capitan, let go of one of those, you know, the war dogs they used to have? I forget. The Matisse
dogs
that they were like war dogs. So he let him loose, and it ripped the stomach of this cacique. And according to the story, De La Casa talks about this, he held his intestines, you know, while the dogs were ripping him apart. And when word got out from him about his death, he's a chief, right? Low-ranking chief. That's when the war began against the invaders. That was the first. You know, if you're going to play the conch shell, like, that's the war. That was the first one. When it's all hell broke loose.
That would do it.
And then one of my favorite other caciques is from, I always chop up his name, Kotumanama. He was from the Dominican Republic. Think about him, that was cool. He was taller than most of the men. He was probably like 6 feet tall, according to the Spaniards. And he was built really strong. So I guess he'll be like the luchador wrestler back in the day,
yeah.
Man. And he would just kick butt in the battle scenes. They said he would just destroy people, hand-to-hand combat. But eventually he was killed, though. You know, they probably waited till he was exhausted, you know, to attack him. But he did die hand-to-hand combat. But the techniques of these Spaniards were ruthless. They will cut you up. They'll make you bleed to death, you know, with a sword.
Burn
that's
you
probably
alive.
What happened. Yeah, exactly. So that's probably what happened. You know, it's funny. The invader for Jamaica, he trained Ponce de Leon in the Dominican Republic. Damn, what was his name? Esquiel? That's what he would do. He would take Taino slaves and he would let them loose. Like, okay, you're free, right? And then the first thing they would do, they'll try to attack him, to kill him. He was so evil, this guy. So he will let him attack him, and then he'll bring out his swords, and he'll slice them up in half, whatever, and he would constantly do this. And he figured that Taino will learn, right? The warriors will learn, like, don't do this, right? But they try. They try to kill this man. So, I don't know, man. That's off the topic, but I just wanted to share that.
No, yeah.
The whole St. Oliver is beautiful. Yeah, if people download the book or buy the book, it's chapter 21. It talks about he refers to them as freedom fighters. And he goes into the battle for Higüey and all that stuff and Cuba. Up in Arms, chapter 19. It's called Taino Freedom Fighters, you know, in Higüey and Borinquen. He breaks it down a lot. He gets into Cuba later on. But, yeah, man, it's some good stuff. The Rebellion of the Caciques in 1511. You know, it's some good stuff in that book. A lot of reading. But check it out, guys, before we go. We didn't talk about the Bejiques. Oh, what's going on here?
Yeah, let's do it. Talk to us about the Bejiques, because obviously, I mean, Steph had kind of started to mention just how important they are. And obviously, you know, Sanacori being one, we can tell you, of course, just how important they are.
here it is. Thanks. Thank you for that show.
Yeah.
La Relación of Fray Ramón Pané. He was sanctioned, right, by Columbus to write as much as he could on our spirituality. So this is from chapter 15-16, okay? Chapter 16. Just a little, and I'd like to know your opinion. Hold on a second. See, now I lost the thing. I'm trying to get an excerpt, which is kind of funny. Oh, here it is. Okay, entering the sick man's bohío, the doctor sits down and all fall silent. If there are any children in the bohío, they are put out, so they will not interfere with the Bejiques' work. Only one or two of the principal men remain. Oh, this is deep. Get the children out, right? Then the bohique takes some huello herb, huello, which is also from the creation stories, right? Wide, and another herb wrapped in an onion leaf 4 inches long. But the royal herb is what they all generally use. And taking it between his hands, he mashes it into a pulp. And then he puts it in his mouth at night so as to vomit anything harmful that he may have eaten. Then he begins to sing his chant. And picking up a torch, drinks the juice of that herb. This done, he is quiet for a time. And then he rises, goes toward the sick man, who lies alone in the middle of the bohío, and walks about him twice or as many times as he thinks proper. He then stands in front of him and takes him by the legs, feeling of his body from the thighs to the feet, and after which he draws his hands away forcefully, as if pulling something out. Then he goes to the door, shuts it, and speaks to it, saying, "Be gone to the mountain or the sea, or where you will, then after he has blown like one who blows chaff from his hand, he turns around, joins his hands together as if he were very cold, blows on his hands, and sucks in his breath as if sucking marrow from a bone. Then sucks at the sick man's neck or stomach or shoulder or cheeks or the belly or other part of the body. Having done this, he begins to cough and make a face as if he had eaten something bitter. Then he spits out into his hand the stone or the bone or the piece of meat that he put in his mouth at home or on the road. And if it's a piece of food, he tells the sick man, you must know that you have eaten something that caused this illness, this sickness from which you suffer. So how I have taken it, see how I have taken it out of your body, where your semi lodged it, because you did not pray to him or build him a shrine, or gave him some land. So, hold on a second. So he gives him the stone and he says, take good care of it. Sometimes they believe that these stones are good and they help women in childbirth. And they take good care of them, wrapping them in cotton, placing them in small baskets, and putting food before them. They do this the same with the semis they have in their houses. On a holiday, when they have much food, fish, meat, or bread, they put some of each food in the house of the semi. And the next day, they carry this food back to their bohios after the semi has eaten. But it will truly be a miracle if the semi actually ate. For the semi is a dead thing of stone or wood. Yeah, a dirty bastard. he, a lot of indirects in there, right? But what do you all think about that?
Right.
Any comments?
It's so, like, it's just interesting. Like, it's so, having studied healing and everything across so many indigenous cultures, it's just amazing how the commonalities you see in a lot of it, particularly the idea of, like, you know, they get into real detailed description about, like, you know, the sucking to remove the impurity or whatever. I mean, that's like, there's a class of shamans in indigenous Siberian culture that are literally, their name translates to like suckers or sucking doctors or something, which is literally because their method of healing is locating the source of whatever illness or pain or impurity within the body as a kind of physical manifestation of something and literally drawing it out, right? So
right.
it's just interesting because it's so very literal, you know, compared to like medicine and how we heal nowadays. Like, you go into a doctor, he's not going to put his mouth on you anywhere, hopefully, and suck anything out of your body. But it's that concept of, you know, something foreign invading the body that needs to be physically drawn out, and doing it in a very visceral and very spiritual sense at the same time.
Right.
And only the Hikes have the ability to do that, right? To be able to locate those causes of illness or pain or impurity, right? And it's something I'm sure, Sana Kori, you can attest to, that takes not only training, but also just something I think that you're born with to some degree, right? Like a sense for that kind of thing.
Well, what's like any role in the community? And this is what I want to bring up before. It's what the people think you, what they say you are. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? So it's the people that choose you. You know, I guess in the traditional sense would be the elders, you know, the grandma council, since we have a matriarchal society. But yeah, definitely, it's the community that calls you. You know, some people walk away from that responsibility, which is cool. It's a human choice. But yeah, if you look really deep inside, you know, into a community, you know, they choose you. They tell you who you are. You know, it's for you to find the right teachers or whatever. I know personally, when I first read this, I took it literally. I did that. I mean, wow, this is a gem. This is something that Bani was kind of making fun of it, but he's not making this up. These are nuggets, you know? So I remember when I first started doing healing ceremony. To this day, I still do that. And many people who have been to a ceremony of mine. Instead of gueyo, I chew tobacco, which is the andujo that they make in the Dominican Republic. Is that fermented tobacco, you know? I once had tobacco tea, which is really, it's too intense for me. But when
you
chew
that
it,
sounds awful.
And then when you, so when you get into the ceremony aspect of that spiritual level with a sick person, what I do is, you know, I suck that negative energy out, and that can be very dangerous, you know. So what happens is when you do that, I've when I first started doing it, I was embarrassed because, you know, you start vomiting, you know. So I learned to have a bucket instead of vomiting.
But you have to expel
room,
it,
you know?
Right? Because other you can't keep it inside your, like you said, it's dangerous.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. So, but you feel it. I'm not making this up. When you do it correctly, in a sense of when you let go of your ego or this sort of inflated ego, say, oh, I can do this, you know. Once you let that go, there's something about the medicine, the tobacco, when you chew it. There's something about that that it makes you really weak, like as long as you can't walk, you know. And that's when you can say, okay, I'm just a tool. I'm just a vessel. Go for it, you know. And that's when, you know, you can feel that negative energy. It's like nasty, like, ugh. And then you just throw up. So I know when, what's his name? Ramon Panay was writing this, he was making a joke out of it, but I'm telling you, there's a deep metaphysical level if you really follow these steps. And I don't recommend people doing this without proper, you know, like a teacher teaching you this, because, you know, you can get sick. You can get really sick, especially people have cancer or, like, all these diseases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're sucking that negative energy, but you have
to
get it out. You can't
yourself,
take it with you.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so I see that Vejiga, that was their role, man, is to just like the cacique, self-sacrificing, you know, to lead the people, orderly fashion, structure, and, you know, make sure everything's tight. The Vejiga was, all right, we have to make sure people are healthy, you know, and they will do certain rituals so people can heal, you know, and a lot of it's mental, you know. We're learning this now more than ever, right? From mindful meditation, all this is that mental,
sure.
The mental, the psychic, right? And I think this is what
is
doing. Yeah, he was connecting to this person's. And it's funny how they took the children out the room, because I guess, you know, this is focusing. You know,
I guess it's dangerous, and it's, you know,
yeah,
it's focused, but also, like you said, it's dangerous, and children are vulnerable. You don't want to get them accidentally pulled into any of that, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you know, I've met medicine people who don't, like, afterwards, that they don't cleanse correctly. That means they don't take care of themselves, and, you know, they can become alcoholic, drug addicted, because what they experience, you know, could be horrible. Sometimes they can't shake it. That's why you need that a teacher or support, you know. And, you know, Cacique was also a medicine man. He was also the Vejiga. He learned under the Vejiga. The Vejiga took the child that will soon will be a cacique. It will take him to the caves. All those petroglyphs you see on the caves, those are teachings, you know. So to the Vejiga. So the Vejiga, I mean, to the Cacique. So when the Cacique became a cacique, he was also a Vejiga. So I'm still researching this, though. If you guys find out, let me know. But I want to know, something happened that De La Casas was talking about, that he noticed that the Vejiques were stripped from the Cohova ceremony. Because that was one of the private ceremonies that was only done by the cacique and the Vejique, was the Cohova ceremony, when they commune with the ancestors, the Senis.
And what
somehow
happened?
They were, that responsibility was taken away from them. So basically, the Vejiga only did the, well, not only, but they basically did the healing ceremonies, but not the Cohova. So,
I didn't know that. I'm surprised.
Yeah. I mean, my theory is that maybe because they were losing so much power, you know, with the invaders coming in.
Right.
That maybe this was their last chance to hold on to power, you know, for their people. And they used the Cohova. Because that's the thing. It was the Cohova ceremony. Then they will share what they learn. Then they'll do the Bate ceremony, which is communal. And then they will do the Arretos, which is also communal. But they will always start with the private ceremony first, which was Cacique and Vejiques, because they were all Vejiques. But at the end, it was the leaders that. So I want to find out why. Were the Vejiques punished?
Yeah, I'm curious myself. Yeah, I'm wondering.
Or was it, I want to say they just were holding on to that power, you know, because they were losing everything. Well, that's it. That's
right.
My
but
thoughts
you would think
the then
you would wanna hold on to the healers, right? You would need them now more than ever.
Yeah. Yeah, because at Kohoba, you know, that's when you commune with the Samis.
Right, and they would need all the advice, I would say, and all the intermediaries that you can get, and that's what a Bihike does, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I know I read in a book that the Bihike will wear, similar to a fancy dancer with the feathers, the two bustles, he will wear feathers on his bottom, and on his arms he will wear, and his shoulders he will wear feathers. So when he goes into the trance, you know, when he's leaving his body, he can fly to the celestial vault, you know, the celestial heavens. He can fly. But that's kind of
right.
Cool that the Bihikes would do that. A lot
yeah,
of ceremony,
awesome.
Right? A lot of ritual. A lot of ritual. But how about Gaisi Hu? Can anyone mention about Gaisi Hu? Why was he so major? Can anyone talk about that? I know this is the what do you call that? Extra credit points.
Yeah,
Stephanie
I'm trying to think.
I know Stephanie knows this.
Gaisi
Hu. Huh?
You said I know it?
Yeah.
You want to give me a pop quiz at 11:30 at night?
Oh, man, that's messed up. See, so all you listeners,
yeah, it's
your turn.
I've been talking for a while.
Okay, well, Gaisi Hu, he was the one that Ramon Panet interviewed. Gaisi Hu, he interviewed him. He was a cacique. And Gaisi Hu shared that he had this Cohoba vision that they are entering the end. Actually, Panet wrote this, but it was before Panet and the invaders showed up, that his vision was of Nukohova, that the end of the caciques were over, that there will be a strange people
there's
will
no
come
more
to them.
Caciques and a strange people were going
yeah, oh, yeah,
to approach
right.
the land. Mm-hmm.
There you go. So Ramon Panet wrote
yeah,
that.
I
so I guess he wrote it. I guess he wrote it to scare the people. Like, oh, you see, we are going to win, you know. He probably told
mm-hmm.
Columbus that, right? Like, look, they admitted defeat. But was it defeat? I don't know. The end of an era, right? The caciques,
sure.
I guess the social structure, I guess, right?
I think that's exactly it. I think it was just the end of an era. And in regards to the idea of the Bihikes being stripped of the Cohoba ceremony, it may be just out of, you know, just to play devil's advocate and throw out a theory, you know, so if anybody listening does run into any information, please share it because I would be very interested in hearing it as well. But just as a theory, let's say that the caciques, because of everything that was going on and because the caciques were so willing to always sacrifice themselves first and immediately, maybe they removed the Cohoba ceremony from the Bihikes so that the Bihikes had the opportunity to take everything that they knew and not be targeted as the culture keepers and being eradicated first, you know, considering how spiritual and how important Cohoba and the ceremony was to our people to protect the Bihikes and the cultural continuity of what and who we were as Taino people. Maybe the caciques stripped the Bihikes of that rite of passage to protect them and allow the ceremony and the culture to continue, you know, and then the Spaniards, the Europeans, would have assumed that it was the cacique who was always this almighty, this king being, according to them, who had all of the knowledge. And they would have never thought to even include the Bihikes in that role of importance and servitude, because caciques and Bihikes worked hand in hand. You know, they counseled one another. They, you know, supported one another. So removing them from being a target could have just been strategy in order to help preserve the culture that we now, you know, have, the information that we were able to retain.
That's it. That's it. Wow. Well, Now we 1500, 1600, 17, 18, 19, 20. Still picking up those pieces, right, of organization. But that leads to the last mm-hmm. question. How do we reorganize, right? Do we recreate the wheel, or do we follow folks before us that kept it alive, right? The Hibaru culture. I know the Hibaru culture was fierce. They had a lot of structure.
And the Hibaru culture is still fierce.
What's that?
Hibaru culture is still...
Yeah, man, they were organized.
And I said in the Wajiro culture, which is the Cuban equivalent.
That's it, yeah. See, this is the thing where sometimes I think we get a little arrogant and we can say, we're going to recreate this, you know? But guess what? It's already, you know, an evolution already occurred, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like we're not recreating the wheel. Something was already in motion, 1500,
exactly.
1600, 1700, 1800. Because to say that we're recreating it is like saying, oh, it died, right?
Exactly. Right. And I think that's exactly the point mm-hmm. where everybody has that sense of misinformation. So many people have walked into the Taino resurgence and this quote-unquote Taino movement trying to pick up from the 1400s and replay 1400 in 2020,
yeah.
2021. And then there are other groups that are completely ignoring the traditions that were able to sustain throughout those, you know, centuries, and ignoring the culture behind it all. And I think what people really need to do in regards to a means
right.
of really creating a substantiated format for who the Tainos were, because we weren't an extinct group. We are not an extinct group. We are here.
Right.
We are strong. We are resilient. We are present. You know, we are prominent. People need to be able to modernize what has already been proven and what is already substantiated. So it comes down to
right.
what are you willing to do in regards to your research, your understanding of the culture, your presence within the culture. How are you keeping the culture? How are you teaching that to others? How are you
yep.
building up your tequinas and your yucayecs, you know, and how are you formulating language and language skills and the idea of rebuilding, not even rebuilding, building on top of the foundation that has already been in existence for hundreds and thousands of years. What
right.
are we doing to add to the foundation? Not take away, not rebuild, but we're adding to a foundation that was already created.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's the thing. A lot of people get confused. I know I see this a lot, and it happened to me. For example, you go to a reservation, right, that's federally recognized or state, whatever, right? And immediately, hey, they're not dressed like Indians. They're not really Indians. Or they're dark skinned, you know, they're not. And then, and it's like, wait, but, you know, they evolved. They, you know, they're not wearing feathers like every day anymore. You know, it's ceremonial or whatever, powwow. You know, you can wear jeans. You can wear boots. You can wear cowboy hats, you know? or sometimes it's funny. I go, and it's going to sound like I'm making fun of people. Please forgive me, but sometimes you go to these ceremonies, right, and they got to, like, you have to have a special cloth. You have to have a special string. You have to have a special tobacco. You got to tie them up 800 times, whatever, you know, all these rules, right? And yet, when I first went to Crow Nation, I saw people giving cigarettes to the medicine man that was doing the ceremony. Cigarettes, you know, that's what they had. So it's like sometimes we get lost in this how it has to be, you know? This is how it has to be. You got to wear nagua, feathers. But I think it's choice, right? It's choice.
Absolutely, and it definitely starts with the leaders. You know, once
yeah.
the leaders exhibit that level of humility, when the leaders exhibit that those characteristics, those are the characteristics that the tribal members that support them are going to inherently develop as well. They're going to hone into that. They're going to, see where they resonate. That's how they'll know if that's really where they belong. You know, a Yukayek is a community. It's a home. It's a family. So as Taino people who are now rebuilding these specific families and communities, you know, it's important that the people who call your Yukayek home feel at home, not a toxic home, but a home where they are, you know, sheltered and appreciated and listened to, and, you know, they receive these endearing feelings of importance and understanding and cultural integrity and the understanding that they are validated in everything that they would like to do within the Yukayek in and of itself. So, I definitely think with leadership has has always, from the beginning of the Taino people to now, leadership will always be that format of structure, the head of the household, where you become that figure for the people within the household to emulate and be like. And as far as character goes, like I said, that nobility, that humility, the wanting to care consistently and honestly.
And that's why y'all caciques and bajiques are so important.
I know.
We're
and
only as important,
you know,
as the people who we serve.
It's funny, before COVID, when I did the Indigenous Mobile Library, people will ask me, oh, how can I connect to a community, right? And I will ask them, so what do you like, you know? What kind of stuff do you like? So sometimes if a person is into fashion or into the arts, you know, the external, that kind of view of it, you know, that I won't say romanticism, but, you know, I'll say, oh, I think this group is great because they do dances, you know, they're on the powwows, and I think this group will be good for you. And I show them photos and stuff. And say, oh, yeah, I like that. And then, all right, you should check them out, you know. Or if you like studies more, this might be better for you. If you like government, this might be more for you. I remember you
join
doing
us in
that.
The nerds group.
Yeah, right? That's the thing, you know. But so we have that diversity now, which is awesome, you know. We have that. And, you know, I just want to say that there's a whole underground of Taino people that go to churches, you know. A lot of them feel kind of alienated because they don't fit in, you know, a lot of them. And I kind of feel bad for them because they've been hurt in that sense. They've been isolated, you know, or not isolated. What is it? Alienated because of their religion. So, because there's a whole group of Dainos like that too, you know, they could be Catholic, Pentecostal, but I think we need to learn, I think we need to grow more on that, right? I think because of our intergenerational trauma, we bring up Jesus, we kind of shake, right? But there's a whole crew out there, I know it, I know who you are. You know, and they go to churches, but they still do their prayers, you know, they still do their ceremonies. So maybe one day we could all get together, right? But Stephanie, you're right. We're all families. We're all Yukayekes, actually, right? And all these Yukayekes are coming together. And within that, all these leaders, all these caciques, right? The head of the household. And that's leading to maybe, you know, common ground, right? I don't know. Wow. But I think our Hibato culture is definitely a good indicator, right? Where we should start. I don't know. I'm
absolutely
just thinking out loud.
The Hibato culture is a good starting point for getting back to our roots. I think, you know, being able to know the land, know the people, have that humility, be able to be self-sustaining, be able to create community, be able to maintain family, be able to have structure. The modern Hibaro traditions and the modern Hibaro just overall lifestyle
mm-hmm.
is very, very similar to our, what people consider, quote unquote, ancient indigenous lifestyles. So I think the Jíbaro culture is a great starting point for people to start to understand and create their own personal think pieces and how they can reconnect to the culture. And for the people who have started to reconnect to their culture, how they can maintain a genuine level of cultural continuity with traditions and their indigenous identity as a whole.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I love you, Jíbaro culture, but they were robbed. I had a mean great-grandmother, but she loved me. But she was me. But they took it seriously, right? They took culture seriously. They took discipline seriously, you know, and they wanted us to learn, right, to grow, to be safe, to learn.
Mm-hmm. They wanted respect. They wanted to give respect. Yeah. They wanted to receive respect. You know, they want you to respect the land. They want you to respect the earth. Everything is rooted in respect, and they take high offense to not having that level of respect, that level of understanding. If you say something, you do it. You know, if you want to do something, you get it done. You know, it's not about fancy words. It's about simplicity. It's about the understanding and the connection. So, you know, for me personally, I think the Jíbaros got it. They know the secrets.
That's right, man. You know, Natalie, I don't know if you probably come across this, and also Stephanie, your studies in sociology and stuff, and anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember in class, actually, I was in seminary at the time. We're taking a sociology and society class, sociology of a society, and out of nowhere, you know, I got my attention. The professor was talking about morals in different societies, morality and so on, ethics and codes and whatever. And they were comparing different countries when it came to honoring and shame and all. And this professor, oh my God, I can't remember his name, but caught my attention. It was like, there's one region in the world that society-wise, culturally-wise, have not lost this. And it's honor and shame. There's no in-between. It's either honor or shame. And he mentioned the Caribbean, the Caribbean cultures. They all have this in common about either you're a person of honor or you're going to shame the family. You're going to shame the community, you know? It's like no in-between.
Sounds about right.
And I was like, oh. Yeah, and when he said that, I'm like, oh, dang. I thought of my great-grandma right away, like, oh, man, if you bring shame to the family, you're in trouble,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
There's no buts, whats, maybe, nah. Deja eso.
Yeah.
Get to sit there, you know?
Well, yeah. I think that goes to, I mean, Caribbean culture, yes, but, like, any culture that's, again, like, non-Euro-American, because they're much more individualistic societies, whereas we're much more of a communal cultures, you know, like
right.
we believe in, you know, the connection of the community, not like in necessarily focusing on like the individual themselves. So that's why it is, I think, like, you know, decisions you make just don't
right.
just affect you, you know, they affect everybody around you. So I think that's personally where I think it comes from. And again, you see it more in non-Western cultures or non-Euro-American cultures rather, because we are more focused on the community and the effects and influence that individuals have on the community. So yeah, like whether it's your family, you know, your yucayec, your town even, yeah, like. And that's why, you know, if you do something, if something happens with anyone, everyone's going to know, you know, there's nothing secret.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny, I remember talking to this lady in Colosal, who was an activist, and she echoed the same thing as other women activists in Comerio. They do work in the community. I won't mention their names. I don't have permission, but it's one thing they both said in common, and it was like, we're talking about the Taino movement and our politics and stuff, and it was like, yeah, we're always fighting one another. I would say, yeah, I think it's the Spaniard blood in us. No, I think it's the Indian, man. Maybe, no, lo indio didn't play. You know who I don't. you know. And then they would name like all these activists in the community, and they would all fight each other, and they were like, you know, they all disagree. And but at the end of the day, when the fighting needs to be done, they all got together, you know. It's about there, you know.
Yeah. You know, we unite when we have to, when it's important.
Yeah, but they were like fighting. And I've seen it too, like picking each other, like, ah, we can't.
Yeah.
Oh, we gotta
well,
do it like
same
this.
As in my family.
Right. That whole, you know.
And about
that whole
y'all,
fighting
when
thing.
When I'm with the Cubans again, yeah, everybody goes at each other until like. Until there's something
know,
like
man.
Bigger, and then everybody's like solid as a rock, you know.
Yeah. Well, I remember my cousin. Then now may his spirit rest. Sometimes he follows me around, but the thing is, man, he, you know, sometimes he'll get, you know, this is in 1970s. He get high, impaired judgment, and one day he made the mistake of hitting his girlfriend. And I remember as like a 7-year-old. I woke up. It was like 6 in the morning, son. His mother, my great aunt, was kicking his ass. And I remember her taking a garbage can, plastic. No, you know those big garbage cans or plastic? It broke in pieces. He said, "This is the last day you're going to hit a woman." Bam! Like in front. I'm like, oh, my God. I was so frightened by
well,
that.
Well, hopefully he learned his lesson then.
But that's the chief right there. Chiefest, right?
Yeah, that's a cacique.
Oh my God, that was talking about Shane, right? But they come from the Hilo culture. But yeah, man, it's like, man, we can go all night. We super overtime. We got a few minutes. Any
as
closing
always.
Words? Yeah, I know, right? Well, damn, Tainos can talk too much.
Exacto.
Any final words? And you're a tequina, actually. Natalie, you're a tequina. You're a teacher, anthropologist, teacher. You're a tequina. Yeah. So you're part of the roles of the community.
Yeah, and I guess my final words would be, you know, keep listening and keep asking questions, especially from people. I mean, as Steph said and as you've all said before, like, these leadership roles in Taino communities aren't meant to be a hierarchy. They're just meant to be kind of a system of caring for one another, right? They're really responsibilities, if anything, and very serious responsibilities that those who have proven themselves capable of are bestowed with. Doesn't make anyone more or less important than anyone else, but I mean, I am always very curious to talk to anyone within a particular culture or community of any kind who has a specific role of that sort, because they are some of the most they're some of the big keepers of that culture of cultures, particularly indigenous cultures or more smaller and more peripheral cultures, and I find them to be the most, enlightening when I speak to them about, you know, their role in maintaining the community. So I want to thank you both for sharing that with me and enlightening me in that sense.
Oh, awesome. That's awesome, man. Thank you. Tequina. about you, Steph, a.k.a. Casica. Creepy stuff.
That's me. I wear many hats when it comes to Taino Radio. First and foremost, I'd like to say thank you guys for sharing space with me today. You know, this is not one of my usual show listings. So, you know, I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate the open-mindedness, you know, the ability to have dialogue and share information and education for everyone to be able to understand further their connection to what it means to be indigenous and what it means to specifically be Taino in regards to the topic of the evening. I think my biggest takeaway and my biggest sound bite for the night going to be research, research. And
that's
research.
A hell of a term.
You're researching.
Right. Research, research, and research. Peer-reviewed research. Interpersonal studying. Don't be afraid to compare and contrast. Don't be afraid to point out inconsistencies between certain things, because somewhere in between the inconsistencies is going to be some information that is going to culminate both pieces of ideas and text. You know, it's important to research, research, and research, especially when it comes to culture and language that were thought to be eradicated and erased. You know, everybody is going to have a rendition of an idea. Everybody is going to have an interpretation of an idea. So being able to sit down and listen to the study hour with Nat and Sanakori is a joy. Everyone who does have the opportunity to listen, it's an opportunity for them to gather insight from two people who have worked hard to be able to gather information, share the information, and bring views into a solid viewpoint for people to really understand in a modern sense and break down the stereotypes behind that, you know, culture and Caribbean culture really is. So, you know, it's been a great appearance this evening, and you know, like I said, I am very humbled to be able to share space with the two of you in your space of expertise.
Nice. Igual.
Thank you. Beautiful. And you know, this is unity too. We got two Yucayeques representing here, and you know, we're one people. You know,
exactly.
We're one people.
One nation.
One nation. So I'd like to close the show. Thank you all for being here, giving up your awesome time for absolutely free, because you're teaching and you're serving, right, the community.
What's
that old term? I forget now, but there used to be a term they used to use. May God repay you, because I can't. It's an old term in the church.
Yeah.
In the Catholic church, they would say
God's
that.
Ears.
Yeah, right. But these are words I researched in the Borinqueniki language. Now it's the Taino-Aiki language. Javier Hernandez. The translation is, we respond to the struggle of resistance and freedom. Wak asukta atuma sabaragua oria ishi saragua. Amuni, ahutira, freedom. All right, all. Thank you, and have a super night. Pleasant dreams. All right. And all you listeners,
yeah.
If you stood up for 2 hours, you're the best. And all you future downloaders, thank you for downloading the show. Please share it. All shows are archived. Right. This is Taino Radio signing off. Thank you all. Have a safe night.
Atavera gua gua bibi gua gua bibi. Atavera gua gua bibi gua gua baba. Atavera gua gua bibi gua gua kiana guti. Atavera gua gua suimako. Atavera gua gua suimako. Thank you.